200, mostly women and children. The Islamic resistance in Iraq carries out new anti-Israeli operations, targeting two barracks and a base in the occupied Golan and the occupied Palestinian territories. And the World Court is set to begin hearings in a case brought by Nicaragua against Germany, accusing Berlin of facilitating Israeli genocide in Gaza through giving arms to Tel Aviv. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. Thanks for joining us. Israel has launched fresh airstrikes on artillery shells on Gaza, keeping the Palestinian territory in a state of catastrophe. Six civilians were killed in the regime's aerial attacks on a commercial facility south of the Nuseirat refugee camp in central Gaza. Israeli warplanes also hit a group of people in a town near the southern city of Rafah, killing at least one and injuring several others. In Gaza City, six dead bodies were recovered from under the rubble of a house that was bombed by the Israeli military. The death toll from the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza since October the 7th stands at nearly 33,200, most of them women and children. The genocidal campaign is now in its seventh month, despite international calls to end the bloodshed. The UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Palestine warns that the Gaza situation is simply catastrophic. International aid organizations have decried the colossal death toll from 6 months of Israel's onslaught in Gaza and other devastating effects that it has left on the besieged strip. The World Health Organization chief said this would remain a stain on all of humanity. Tedros Adhanom said the denial of basic needs, food, fuel, sanitation, shelter, security, and health care is inhumane and intolerable. The International Federation of the Red Cross and the Red Crescent Societies described the situation as, quote, beyond catastrophic, with millions of lives at risk of hunger. It warned that humanity has been all but abandoned. The Secretary General of the international medical charity Doctors Without Borders says international humanitarian law is being violated on a daily basis in Gaza. He has described the worsening situation in hospitals across the besieged territory.
We are definitely seeing rising rates of malnutrition. We are up to the in the situation in places like the Al-Aqsa Hospital, which is in a middle area of Gaza. We're in a really critical situation where our medics there are having to choose between giving beds to trauma patients who are seeking assistance and medication and surgery for some horrendous wounds, and giving those beds to malnourished children. So we're absolutely seeing rapidly increasing rates of malnutrition. Firstly, there needs to be much more supply coming in, much more land crossings opened. And at the same time, that needs to, what we need to be aware of is that it's much more than counting trucks across the border. And a lot of the narrative that we have seen in terms of supply in this conflict has been oversimplified. And actually moving supplies around the Gaza Strip is critical. Being able to have medics who are qualified, fed in a mentally fit state to be able to treat patients is essential for providing humanitarian assistance. And hospitals, if I look at it from a hospital perspective, are obviously more than four walls and a roof. They're about running water, electricity, fuel, communication. And just on international humanitarian law, there are now 200 aid workers that have been killed in the Gaza Strip. There was the tragic incident from the World Central Kitchen just this week, which has brought attention to this issue. But international humanitarian law is being broken on a daily basis in the Gaza Strip.
A cancer-stricken Palestinian prisoner has passed away, aged 62, after spending nearly four decades in Israeli jails. Walid Daka died on Sunday at a hospital near Tel Aviv. He suffered from chronic lung diseases and was diagnosed with bone marrow cancer in December 2022 as a result of decades-long detention. Daka's condition deteriorated further due to severe pneumonia and kidney failure reported in March of last year. The Palestinian Prisoners Society has attributed his death to medical negligence and Israel's policy of slow killing against sick inmates. Daka was arrested in 1986 and remained behind bars under the regime's so-called administrative detention policy, in which a person is held without trial for an indefinite period of time. According to prisoner groups, Israeli jail authorities frequently delay checkups and urgent surgeries for Palestinian inmates. Clashes have broken out between Palestinian resistance fighters and Israeli occupation forces in the occupied West Bank. The resistance fighters have reportedly destroyed an Israeli bulldozer in eastern Nablus during these clashes. The Islamic resistance in Iraq says it has targeted three Israeli military sites in the occupied territories in response to the regime's massacres of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The resistance group announced that it had struck an Israeli barracks in the occupied Syrian Golan Heights using a drone. The group added that it had also targeted another barracks as well as a military base in the occupied Palestinian territories. The resistance group underlined that it will continue to target Israeli positions and interests in solidarity with Gazans, who have been under incessant Israeli attacks for more than 6 months. In recent months, the Islamic resistance in Iraq has carried out a series of attacks against Israeli targets. It has also hit U.S. military bases in Iraq and neighboring Syria, retaliation for Washington's support for the Israeli genocide in Gaza. The International Court of Justice is set to hear Nicaragua's genocide case against Germany for supporting Israel. Nicaragua has accused Germany of facilitating the commission of genocide against Palestinians by supporting Israel's war in Gaza. It hopes that the case, if won, would suspend Germany's military assistance to the Israeli regime. The preliminary hearings will take place today in the Dutch city of The Hague. The court will likely take weeks to deliver its decision. Germany is dealing with a similar situation domestically as well. Hundreds of German civil servants have called on their government to cease weapon deliveries to the Israeli government immediately. Iran's foreign minister says Israel is caught in the Gaza quagmire as the regime has achieved none of its goals in its war on the Palestinian territory. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remark in a presser with his Omani counterpart in Muscat. The Iranian foreign minister said Israel is following the policy of warmongering and escalation in the region. He added that Washington has always fully supported Tel Aviv's warmongering policy. Amir Abdullahian also pointed to Israel's attack on the Iranian embassy in Syria. He noted that the U.S. cannot shirk its responsibility for its support for Israeli crimes. Amir Abdullahian said that Iran is an island of stability and security in West Asia, adding that the Islamic Republic will not allow anyone to violate the country's national security. The Omani Foreign Minister Saeed Badr al-Busaidi, for his part, said Tehran and Muscat will work together to find solutions to regional tensions, including the Israeli aggression against Gaza. Following his visit to Oman, Iran's foreign minister will travel to Damascus as part of a regional tour. Turkish police have detained dozens of protesters demanding an end to the country's trade ties with Israel. Footage has gone viral of Turkish riot police violently forcing protesters into vans in Istanbul. Turkish activists said protesters were also tortured. In public, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been severely critical of Israel, even comparing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to Adolf Hitler. Turkey, however, continues to export a whole range of products to Israel, including explosives, aircraft parts, and weapons and ammunition. On the streets, tens of thousands of Turks have been holding anti-Israel rallies during the genocide in Gaza. Earlier we discussed the issue with Jim Kavanaugh, political analyst and blogger, who joined us from New York. He told us that Turkey, under Erdogan, is an opportunist state and will continue its trade ties with Israel.
President Erdogan is a character who's extremely shrewd. You know, he has a basic ideological opposition to Israel and Zionism that he's going to state. But as you say, he's going to continue business as usual. Look, Turkey's exported something like $320 million in goods to Israel since this year. That includes weapons and ammunition. Many countries were normalizing relations with Israel, were absolutely accepting the Zionist project as a fait accompli. And I think Turkey was willing to do that as well. You know, the United States, Joe Biden can get up and say, Israel's, and it's horrible what they're doing, and then give them weapons to do it. You know, they're going over the top with this. They have to stop killing Palestinian civilians, but here are your bombs to do it. And, you know, the spokesman for the National Security Council and for the State Department can't get up and say, after what we saw at the Flower Massacre and Al-Shifa Hospital and the killing of the World Central Kitchen workers, we don't think Israel's doing anything that's against humanitarian law. So you have this phenomena, again, of countries that are playing both sides against the middle and trying to figure out where this is going to go. Uh-huh. And unfortunately, I think Turkey is one of them in that respect.
The World Food Program is reporting a staggering increase in malnutrition cases in Afghanistan, especially among children, amid economic sanctions on the country. authorities says admissions to clinics for malnutrition have tripled over the last year in the capital, Kabul. Press TV's Rahmatullah Bakhwan has more from Kabul.
Afghanistan is now battling an invisible foe that threatens its future generations. The World Food Program has sounded the alarm on the rising tide of malnutrition cases, a crisis worsened by the country's ongoing economic challenges and reduced international aid. Marking the World Health Day, the Taliban's Minister of Public Health expresses concern over the malnutrition crisis, calling for international support. The impact of international sanctions and the U.S. policies cannot be overlooked in understanding the gravity of the situation. That is a warning by pediatricians here in Afghanistan. Years of conflict have severely damaged the country's infrastructure, making it a challenge to provide adequate healthcare and nutrition to vulnerable groups. Moreover, recent cuts in international assistance as well as the Western-led sanctions are worsening things.
There are also some foreign factors exacerbating the malnutrition crisis in Afghanistan. Afghan assets that belong to Afghans and are meant to support our economy are frozen. We are witnessing a decline in international health assistance, especially to our children. Some international bodies continue to collaborate, but these are not sufficient. Some organizations that used to support families have ended their missions in Afghanistan.
A lot of people like me are coming to this hospital because their children are malnourished. I think everything boils down to a single problem, economic shortcoming. If our family had enough to eat, our children wouldn't become undernourished. People don't have money and they're not receiving aid anymore.
Experts emphasize that the need for immediate aid cannot be overstated. Afghan families are in desperate need of assistance to combat this malnutrition crisis. The international community must come together to provide the necessary resources and support to save lives and alleviate the suffering of the Afghan people. The economic crisis in Afghanistan is taking a toll on the health and well-being of the war-ravaged nation. Advocates warn that without a significant increase in support, the crisis will further deepen. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Let's Day rallies and marches have been held in cities across Canada. Participants in the rallies call for immediate end to Israel's genocide in the Gaza Strip. Our correspondent Camila Escalante reports from Toronto.
Thousands came together for the annual International Quds Day March in the Canadian city of Toronto to show their solidarity with the Palestinian people, especially those in the besieged Gaza Strip. Palestinian solidarity organizations and communities rallied across from the U.S. consulate, calling on Ottawa and Washington to act urgently to end the Israeli terror campaign and genocide and try to save as many lives as
possible. And this year it's especially important because people are motivated to come out in large numbers to bring an end to this genocide that's taking place in Gaza and underline their commitment to see a free Palestine from the river to the sea and a free Al-Quds, a free Jerusalem, free from Zionism and occupation.
Millions around the world are marching yesterday, today, and tomorrow, all week. Thousands of cities and towns across the globe are making Al-Quds Day an international day, a call for justice and freedom, particularly for the Palestinian people as they are facing genocide and war crimes in Gaza.
The city has continued its heavy policing of pro-Palestinian demonstrations. Just 1 week ago, several participants were injured and six others were arrested in the annual Land Day commemoration by the Toronto police, who were captured on camera using excessive force.
So last week, people must have seen the videos by now, but the police completely attacked a peaceful rally, and there was horses involved, and this is what the police do. They're on the side of the Zionists, they terrorize people. You know, a protest, a simple, peaceful protest, you're not allowed. I mean, this is another example of the Palestine exception. That protest is good, it's a liberal, you know, it's a sign of democracy, except when you're talking about Palestine. You can't do that.
Participants also use Quds Day to condemn a recent deadly attack by the Israeli regime on Iran's consulate building in Syria's capital, Damascus.
Well, Iran has been subjugated to all forms of aggression at the hands of the Zionist regimes and their backers. But the last crime that Israel have done in destroying the Iranian embassy in Damascus, that is a zero tolerance. Iran will respond, and I think that Iran is being called upon by the people to respond against this Israeli aggression.
As the targeted killing of civilians and the starvation campaign continue, a temporary resident visa program announced by the administration in Ottawa 3 months ago has failed to bring to Canada any Palestinian relatives of Canadians from Gaza. Against that backdrop, families and activists are pressuring for a real arms embargo on Israel. Camila Escalante, Toronto.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
Starvation is getting worse in North Gaza, where 31% of children under the age of 2 are suffering from acute malnutrition, a percentage which has doubled since January. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, approximately 300,000 people remain trapped in northern Gaza facing heightened susceptibility to disease due to severe hunger. Residents in northern Gaza are barely surviving on an average of 245 calories per day, according to a statement released by the international NGO Oxfam. This intake represents less than 12% of an adult's daily caloric needs and don't consider access to proper nutrition, according to the statement. The scarcity of fruits and vegetables, coupled with extreme price hikes, has made them unattainable for most. Additionally, specialized nutrition products and malnutrition treatment centers are scarce or inaccessible, Oxfam noted. Before the war, we were in good health and had strong bodies. Now, looking at my children and myself, we have lost so much weight. Since we do not eat any proper food, we are trying to eat whatever we find, edible wild plants or herbs daily just to survive, a mother trapped in northern Gaza told Oxfam. Approximately 300,000 people remain trapped in the area facing heightened susceptibility to disease due to severe hunger. The situation is compounded by the Zionist regime's extensive destruction of civilian infrastructure, including hospitals and water and sanitation services in Gaza. Oxfam International Executive Director Amitabh Bahar said, "Israel is making deliberate choices to starve civilians. Imagine what it is like, not only to be trying to survive on 245 calories day in, day out, but also having to watch your children or elderly relatives do the same. All while displaced with little to no access to clean water or a toilet, knowing most medical support has gone and under the constant threat of drones and bombs." Oxfam's analysis of the latest integrated food security phase classification IPC data for the Gaza Strip reveals alarming figures. Since last October, total food deliveries to the entire population of Gaza, approximately 2.2 million people, have only provided 41% of the daily calories needed per person. The IPC findings underscored the imminent threat of famine in northern Gaza, with nearly the entire population experiencing extreme hunger. Shockingly, 1.1 million people are now facing catastrophic food insecurity. These statistics paint a bleak picture of the humanitarian crisis unfolding in Gaza, highlighting the urgent need for immediate and substantial intervention to address food shortages and prevent widespread starvation. Bahar said, Israel is ignoring both the International Court of Justice order to prevent genocide and UN Security Council resolutions. Only last week, the ICJ ordered new provisional measures stating famine is no longer looming but setting in Gaza, adding that the international community must stop arming Israel and impose an immediate ceasefire. According to the Oxfam official, only then we can stop this horrifying carnage for the 2.2 million people who have endured 6 months of suffering. Israel cannot weaponize starvation any longer. Currently on trial before the International Court of Justice for Genocide against Palestinians, the Zionist regime has been waging a devastating war on Gaza. According to Gaza's Ministry of Health, at least 33,037 Palestinians have been murdered and at least 75,668 wounded in the Zionist regime's ongoing genocide in Gaza starting on October 7th. Moreover, at least 7,000 people are unaccounted for, presumed dead under the rubble of their homes throughout the Gaza Strip. Palestinian and international organizations say the majority of those killed and wounded are women and children. The Israeli regime aggression has also resulted in the forceful displacement of nearly 2 million people from all over the Gaza Strip, with the vast majority of the displaced forced into densely crowded southern city of Rafah near the border with Egypt in what has become Palestine's largest mass exodus since 1948 Nakba. Meanwhile, a new report by the Geneva-based Euromed Human Rights Monitor reveals the killing of 563 Palestinians and the injury of 1,523 others due to the Zionist regime's targeting of people waiting for aid. Distribution centers and workers responsible for organizing, protecting, and distributing aid. Released recently, the report titled Killing Starving Palestinians and Targeting Aid Trucks, a deliberate Israeli policy to reinforce famine in the Gaza Strip, documents incidents between January 11th and March 23, 2024. During that period, Euromed Monitor documented that 256 people were killed in the Kuwait roundabout area in the southeast of Gaza City, 230 on Al-Rashid Street in the southwest of the city, and 21 due to the targeting of aid distribution centers. Documentation also shows that 41 police officers and People's Protection Committee members who were in charge of overseeing aid distribution were killed, along with 12 aid distribution workers, two of whom were from the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA. Evidence suggests that Israel intentionally perpetrates these crimes, including direct military attacks on humanitarian aid and civilians, as part of a deliberate and overarching policy, the reporter stated, adding, "This is evident from the systematic pattern and regular, almost daily recurrence of Israel's commission of these crimes, as well as the high number of victims affected by them." Euromed Monitor said one of the most dangerous forms of unlawful killings and executions carried out by the Israeli army against Palestinian civilians recently is the systematic targeting of civilian gatherings around humanitarian aid trucks with direct gunfire, quadcopters, and Israeli tank shells, especially on the Kuwait and Nablusi roundabouts in the south of Gaza City, which have been dubbed the Flower Massacres. The report lists the various incidents of starving civilians waiting for humanitarian aid being targeted by Israeli forces as follows. On March 23, 2024, 30 Palestinians were murdered and 80 others injured after the Israeli regime army opened fire at those waiting for aid trucks near the Kuwait roundabout on Salahuddin Road south of Gaza City. On March 14, 2024, Israeli regime army forces opened heavy fire on thousands of civilians who had gathered near the Kuwait roundabout on Salahuddin Road in southern Gaza City using tanks, helicopters, and drones. The shooting left more than 80 dead and 200 injured, with a number of them left in critical condition. The next morning, the Zionist regime army forces opened fire on residents who returned to the scene in an attempt to retrieve the bodies of the victims. Many of the bodies had been left underground overnight as Israeli gunfire had made it difficult for them to be transferred. And on March 13th, 6 Palestinians were murdered and others injured while waiting for aid supplies to arrive at the Kuwait roundabout on the outskirts of Gaza City.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. There is no stop to the genocide in Gaza as the Israeli regime kills more Palestinians. This as the Holocaust reaches 6 months. Over 33,000 people have been killed as the so-called international community continues to look on. What has stopped in these 6 months is hope that international law would bring a halt to this genocide. The Israeli regime continues to ignore demands for a ceasefire because there has been no real ramifications exerted against them by the Western hegemonic front. What does it all mean? Well, stay with us as we take a look at this and more on The Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of Detroit, Saeed Khan, Director of Global Studies, Wayne State University. And out in Edinburgh, co-founder Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us. I'd like to start this off in Detroit with Saeed. Did you ever imagine back in October when this particular genocide started, that we would still be witnessing this tragedy 6 months later?
There was always the hope and really the expectation that the international community, particularly those of Western powers and those who claim to have Israel as an ally, would have been able to exert more pressure in light of the carnage, in light of the completely disproportionate toll on civilian life, the devastation and the destruction of Gaza, its infrastructure, and really any viable form of having a quality of life. But what we saw, though, unfortunately, was a rather cynical ploy by Western powers, whether it was for their own domestic political agenda or as an extension of, let's face it, their own imperialistic appetites, that there were few to no constraints that they exerted on Israel other than the rhetorical. And even the rhetorical was very mild. I think it is important to also note, though, that the latest reports are that the Israeli forces are withdrawing from southern Gaza. Whether that is significant due to it being the six-month anniversary or because of the more recent international pressure that Israel has been facing, particularly in light of the targeted killing of seven World Central Kitchen food relief aid workers, has yet to be seen. But we do need to go ahead and then provide all of these contexts to realize that any kind of cessation right now is far too little and far too late.
Well, Mick, the numbers speak for themselves. There have been over 33,000 Palestinians killed by the Israeli regime in these 6 months. And you know, estimates are saying that probably at least 10,000 are still under the rubble. Over 200 aid workers, at least 140 journalists, along with over 685 medical staff have also been killed by the regime during this time. I mean, your thoughts about this? It is absolutely amazing that we are still watching this. I mean, can this be called anything but genocide and crimes against humanity?
Israel has long been accused of crimes against humanity by various United Nations investigations, Goldstone Report, and ever since then. The word genocide is relatively new in official UN parlance, but this slow motion genocide in Gaza for decades and decades has always been punctuated by periodic massacres, 2008-9, 2014, 2021, which the Israelis call mowing the lawn or cutting the grass, on the basis that there is no possibility of negotiating with the Palestinians. How can you negotiate with people when they know the Israeli intention is to remove all of them from Palestine? So therefore, no alternative but to carry on with periodic killings. I mean, there's a brutal logic to all of this, because once the West grew the state of Israel, Britain and France and then the USA, once they grew the state of Israel, provided it with everything it needed in order to grow, nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction, massive economic aid and so on, all predicated on the basis of Zionism, that they would remove as many Palestinians as possible at various different speeds, all of them were really doomed. Now, that when that came to a situation where the Palestinians continued to resist, refused to give in, refused to kiss the boot on their necks, then really, in a horrible sense, Israel had no alternative but to slaughter tens of thousands of them. Because you have to remember, when Western powers have approached black people in Australia, native people in North America, they have always had a huge demographic advantage. So that even when they were defeated militarily, they, as one Native American leader said, they're like leaves on the trees. There were so many. Absolute numbers of Europeans coming to these countries guaranteed their ultimate domination. But Israel is really 7 million Jews in Israel, 6 million Zionist Jews probably, and they're surrounded by 270, 280 million Arabs who switch on their television sets and see people being killed because they are Arabs, because they speak Arabic. So the ultimate outcome of this struggle is not in doubt. But in the meantime, Israel needs to maintain what it calls its deterrent edge, its ability to terrorize people in Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, Iraq, Egypt, and so on, by mass killing. Now, this has not been working. The Lebanese resistance is unbroken, and the Palestinian resistance is suffering huge attacks, but it's not being defeated. And Netanyahu said he was going in to exterminate Hamas, which is, of course, an impossibility, since they're a projection of the Palestinian people themselves. So where we are at the moment is massive genocidal violence, but it's baked into the whole Zionist project. And Israel bombing neighboring countries, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and so on, is also baked into the whole Zionist project. So its ultimate defeat seems to be very, very, very likely, very probable. But until that happens, Israel means war. Israel means violence and attacks on its neighbours. And I mean, from the comfort of my home here in Scotland, I still have to say, Zionism will only be defeated only after it plunges the whole area into war.
Hmm. Well, what about that, Saeed, what Mick has just said, that the Zionist project, it's obvious that it's over, but in the meantime, it will continue to inflict murder and genocide in the region. And first of all, I want to know if you agree with him. And second of all, if you do, why do we still see this Western hegemonic front support for this regime in the way that we're witnessing?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think you do see that there have been acts of provocation that suggest at least some kind of interest in broadening this to a regional conflict. The Israeli bombing of the Iranian consulate in Damascus is clearly meant not only as an act of provocation to try to draw Iran more closely into the conflict, but also to hopefully draw others into the conflict against Iran. The very idea that Prime Minister Netanyahu has for most of his recent political life been trying to get the West to go to war with Iran, the whole idea of making claims that Iran is moving toward a nuclear missile capability, providing false evidence even at the United Nations in 2006. This was even discredited by the U.S. Defense Intelligence Estimate. This is really in some ways about this one individual who doesn't mind burning everything down in order to save his own political career. But at the same time, I think it's important to also recognize that the West, as you had asked, is doubling down on Israel for whatever reasons. It is mortgaging many of its own stated values in order to prop up this this current campaign, which may suggest that the West is itself waning in its power, influence, its geopolitical credibility, and seemingly unconcerned about that. Whether this is because of that ambivalence or whether it is an act of final desperation with other world powers coming to the fore, it doesn't seem to bode well either for Israel or the West if this is going to persist when it comes to this full-throated support for what could best be described by many as a rogue and even a pariah state.
Right. Well, what about that, Mick? What we have seen the last 6 months, and your perspective of what it has done globally to the perspective of individuals about international law, international organizations such as the United States. It's United Nations, which was allegedly set up to prevent this type of genocide or what is happening that we're watching as we speak.
I think we have to look reality in the face, and certainly since 1945. The international laws that were put in place after 1945, after the Nazi exterminations of Jews and Serbs and Gypsies and others, was never meant to be applied to benefit people in Asia or Africa or outside Europe. What they were concerned about was and indeed, you know, it's very clear from the Algerian War of Independence, 1.5 million killed. There was no question of these laws at Nuremberg and the Geneva Conventions being applied there. America killed 3 million Indochinese after its invasion of Vietnam began to go wrong. No question of these of they having any protection from the laws that were passed after 1945. No, these laws have never been applied. The so-called Western values were always a complete myth. If you look beyond them, genocide there was a program on BBC last week, which was quite remarkable. It dealt with the death of 3 million people in Bengal, deliberately allowed by the British to happen in 1943, organized by Churchill. Now, we can discuss that because of the distance of time the BBC can run that. But currently, a lot of people still think that the genocide in Gaza is something out of the norm in European history. But it's nothing of the sort. Now, given the balance of forces at the moment, I have one question. Why doesn't America carpet bomb Yemen? The Yemenis are coming to the aid of the people of Gaza facing genocide. They're attacking Israeli ships in the Red Sea. When the British and the Americans respond and bomb Yemen, they respond by attacking British and American ships as well. In Southeast Asia, and elsewhere, America used B-52 carpet bombing to destroy huge areas of these countries. Why not? I think it's to do with that America's power is declining. It relies on Arab allies more than in the past, because Israel has committed the ultimate crime. Israel was backed by America after 1967 massively. Before 1967, American aid to Israel was fairly modest. But after Israel showed that it could destroy Syrian, Egyptian, and Jordanian armies, that's when American aid began to go through the roof, and very, very quickly. But recently, this Israeli ability to get to prove to its paymasters in Washington that it can police the region, that it is a sturdy attack dog against people who defy America, that's beginning to fail. And I think the failure to crush the resistance in Lebanon, and now the failure to crush the resistance in Gaza, in anything like a respectable time, means that Israel's committing the only sin which counts in Washington, which is failure. And the failure to establish its power to dominate the region, I think, will reverberate for years to come. And that's why Israel is slaughtering so many Palestinian civilians in Gaza, because its ability to strut the stage of the Middle East as invulnerable has mm-hmm. been badly dented. And this by a non-state actor, by another modestly equipped Arab militia. The Palestinian resistance has created a crisis inside Israel, huge demonstrations between different Zionist blocs, and it's created a crisis in world politics as well, in America, Britain, and elsewhere. It's not just that perceptions have changed across the Middle East, which is boiling. It's that millions of people in Britain and in America now view their governments and even their states quite differently than before October the 7th.
Right, right. Interesting points, Mick. What about that, Saeed? I mean, if we look at these 6 months and the changes that have taken place, let's start from here. First of all, a lot of the individuals who have become aware not only of the reality now of the Israeli regime and what it has been doing prior to, of course, October 7, 75 years, but also that their countries that usually say that they support democracy and they stand for human rights and women's rights and kids' rights, but they have done nothing to stop this and they have continued to arm this entity. The significance of this growing awareness that is taking place?
Well, I think it's rather profound. This has really exposed in the last 6 months is a lot of demythification. First, looking at Israel, there was a myth of its military being all powerful, and also, as some were making the claim, all moral. Well, this conflict really completely eviscerated that. First of all, the morality of the IDF, by its own images that it has been transmitting around the world, refused that. But the idea that they were essentially caught completely off guard on October the 7th by Hamas as Mick said, a non-state actor, really exposed the Israeli military for being far less competent, far less capable than it has projected. The second thing is Israel's intelligence and security service, which again has not only been something that is hallowed around the world, but also supposed to be a source for consternation and fear. That proved to be spectacularly incompetent and a failure on October the 7th. And then lastly, I think we have to take a look at the media narrative, which has been for so long dominant and dominated by the Israeli position. That has now changed irrevocably, that now people are starting to see, and to be fair, even within Israeli media like Haaretz and some others, criticism that is unprecedented of not just the leadership of Israel, but some soul-searching about its own mission, its own objective, and its own tactics. So I'm not sure that Israel can really recover from those. On your other issue regarding Western powers, I think that now we can safely say that the sun is setting on so-called Western liberal democracy, or at least the myth of it, that it has been able to, for so long, assert itself, even bully non-Western countries, particularly those in Africa, South America, and in Asia, browbeating them, using it as justification for sanctions and other actions against them to say, we are democracies, this is the gold standard. The credibility of countries like the UK, the US, France, Germany, Australia, and many others is simply not there anymore. And so the idea then that other countries need to necessarily be fearful or act out of a sense of consternation toward Western countries, I think that myth has also been sufficiently shattered.
Well, quite interesting. Your thoughts on that, Mick, if that is the case, if all of this has been shattered. Tell me your perspective of where the United Nations now stand in all of this as far as global perspective, because it would appear that the United Nations has been totally impotent the last 6 months. Do you see now countries, especially those in the Global South and others, trying to find an alternative to that UN system as it has badly failed humanity, especially the last 6 months?
Well, the UN has always, of course, had a built-in American, French, and even British veto. So therefore, it was always emasculated when it came to intervening against, for example, the American invasion of multiple countries, Central and South America, fomenting coups. The myth of liberal democracy, it was precisely that, a myth. We do have democratic rights in this country. We can stand in a street corner and shout. But when it comes to the core interests of the rulers of these countries, they're quite ruthless in America and in Britain in suppressing potential challenges to that politically. Jeremy Corbyn recently built the Labour Party to be a massive party, enjoyed great popularity, had huge rallies across the country, and he was crushed by an alliance of right-wing, the Labour Party right-wing, and the Zionist spearpoint. So that's always been a myth. But what's happened recently is it has burned into people's brains, into their psyche. What's happening in Gaza, surgeons amputating their own children's limbs without anesthetics. Horror piled upon a deeper horror, beyond the imagination of a horror filmmaker, has burned very deeply into millions and millions of people's awareness of what's going on. And they don't just ask about the horror in Gaza. It's so horrible people can't even think about it too much. But they are beginning to say, if our governments are capable of supporting this, they're capable of anything. And the Israeli genocide is an acid eating away at support across the Arab world, of course, when Arabs are being massacred because they're Arabs, but also across Western states as well, that more and more people are moving to a position of opposing what their government does. But within that, more and more, a very, very large number of people, unprecedented in my experience over several decades, an unprecedented number of people are committing themselves to oppose, in however vague a way, however unclear a way, the existing status quo, which they think has led to aggressive war after aggressive war, and now pay by TV genocide. So yes, I think it's quite remarkable. I think we will look back on this from years to come to see this was a seminal moment, that yes, something very big. You know, it's a cliche, and we're taught it all the time in Britain, the world changed after 9/11. Well, it did, only because of aggression and increasing numbers of wars fomented by the Pentagon. But the world is changing at the level of popular belief, popular commitment, and understanding of what's going on because of what's happened, because of the Palestinian resistance and the genocidal response of Israel. They may be able to execute large numbers of people, shoot women and children at close range, make sure that every child in the neonatal unit dies, and create conditions where every single person in an intensive care unit dies. This is now understood by more people than even those who understood the barbarism of the invasion of Iraq. So yes, I think it's a very dramatic moment, and it's going to play out in British politics, and I think in politics internationally.
Indeed. Well, thank you both for being with me on this Spotlight. Syed Khan, Director of Global Studies, Wayne State University out of Detroit, Mick Napier, co-founder, Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Edinburgh. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, thanking you for being with us, and thanking you on behalf of all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering it down some questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Rouhani is the guest speaker for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about the concept of Salatul Arham and what happens if a person cut his ties or give cold shoulders to his close relatives and family members. Sheikh, before getting to cutting ties with the close relatives and family members, let's first be concerned with the definition of Salatul Arham. What does it mean exactly according to Islamic beliefs?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. From the moral perspective, Islam actually emphasizes a lot on this Salatul Arham, which means that you have to be always in contact with your families, with your relatives, and try to be merciful and kind to them, and try to, for example, to take care of them if you could, try to provide them or support them with what they need if you can. That is why it means that you should be always supportive and merciful and kind to your relatives, the people who have a kind of link or relationship with you, and try to be actually, to take care of them, for example, to support them, help them. This is the general meaning of Silatul Arham. It means that you should not cut your, contact or relationship with your communication with your relatives. Rather, try to be always with them. If you can help them, if we could care about them, if we can support them, try to do that. This is one of the religious duties of a Muslim, a mu'min, to be kind, to be merciful to his arham, which means relatives and the people who have a kind of relationship and contact with you.
That's right. And when they say you should not cut ties with them or treat them silently or give them cold shoulder, what do you mean exactly? I mean, does it have any criterion, for example, that during a week or a day or a month we have to pay visit to our relatives and family members by such criterion or not?
You know, in the Holy Quran, it is Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala explicitly says that لَا يُكَلِّفُ اللَّهُ نَفْسًا إِلَّا وُسْعَهَا. It means that you have to be helpful, supportive to them as much as you could. You know, for example, if you have time, if you can go and visit them, yeah, it's better to go and visit them. If you do not have time and really you're busy and you could not make time to go visit them, then of course at least call them, message them, or for example ask about their, let's say, daily, for example, affairs, about this, that whether they have any problem, any need. Even just talking, even just calling them, texting them, messaging them, it is good, you know, because if you completely cut any kind of contact or communication with them, from the Islamic perspective, it is haram, it is forbidden. It is among the major sins.
Yes.
To cut completely, let's say, your contact and your relationship with your relatives, particularly the close relatives like father, mother, brothers, sisters, grandfather, grandmother, aunts, uncles, cousins. These kind of people, you have to be always in contact with them. Try to be try to treat them and behave them with good morality, with good behavior, respectfully. These are the things that are really recommended in Islam, and actually Islam always emphasizes on these kind of values, which are kind of moral and ethical values in Islam.
Okay. So if someone is among our close relatives or friends or family members, even parents and children, is a sinful person, what about that time? Are we allowed to do Salatul Rahim with such a person in Islam?
No, never. Even if he is sinful, mm-hmm. Your duty is to help them, to support them, to guide them as much as you could. Again, like Allahu Nafsan illa wasa. You shouldn't cut completely your contact, your relationship with that person. Mm-hmm. Sinning is something that related to he or she herself.
Okay.
But your duty is something else. Your duty is not to completely cut. Even here, if you try to save him, if you try to, for example, rescue him from that kind of bad situation and sinful kind of conditions, that would have lots of great rewards for you. That's why Silatul Arham is really emphasized in Islam. And even in Islam, it says that if you cut totally the relationship with your relatives, it is haram. Mm-hmm. It is among the major sins.
Okay.
Yeah, that's why, yeah, it's not allowed to do such.
That's all right.
IRIB English Radio presents Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Praise to Allah, all glory to Allah. We worship Allah and no one but Allah.
And some people prefer.
Sorry, just one point should I mention here, that, you know, sometimes, for example, if that person who is very much sinful, not caring about anything, mm-hmm. if you communicate with him or her, then it might have bad influence on you. You know, it will be harmful, dangerous for you yourself.
But if you have the hope that such a person will be guided to the right path, at that time it's okay.
So at least you ask, at least text him, call him sometimes, but do not communicate in a way that it influences you. You know, that you have to first of all, you have to save yourself. Okay. Then you can save others.
That's right.
Yeah, in that case, such a kind of condition is there that you might get, for example, what we can say, sinful by that kind of relationship. Of course, there's no need to...
You become exposed to this...
To communicate.
Or, for example,